Welcome to Inside Seaweed, the podcast looking deep into the seaweed industry through the stories of pioneers, entrepreneurs, and innovators. I'm Fed the Gobby, and my guest today is Sachi Singh, founder and CEO of Rootless. Sachi has a decade of experience in international climate change solutions and a master's in environmental management from Yale University. Sachi is on a mission to bring the health benefits of seaweed to more people, and she's doing so with her brand's product called The Daily Bite. We're going to do a deep dive into seaweed and health, also touching on some really cool and important aspects of entrepreneurship. Please enjoy my wide-ranging conversation with Sachi Singh. Sachi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What I thought we could do today is start from a bird eye view and then zoom into some of the details about seaweed and health, and then zoom out again, look at the wider topics, and probably do this, zoom in, zoom out a few times. Yeah, we're going to do that and see what if we can find some nuggets for the audience.
Sounds great.
I'll start with perhaps a bit of a weird one. You described yourself as a traveling salesman of seaweed.
Oh, gosh, that's true.
What would, say, 8-10 years old Sachi think about that?
Definitely not. That was not on the cards. So I think she would be pretty surprised. I would even say, you know, I'm 33 now. I would even say like 29-year-old Sachi would have been pretty surprised that that's what we were doing. But I think pretty early in my career, I realized that I wanted to be working on climate change and ocean issues. So I'm not surprised that it sort of has taken this turn, but specifically to be going around, you know, being a seaweed salesperson, that was not on the bingo cards.
No, nothing in your quote-unquote origin story that pointed toward seaweed or, I guess, sustainability, perhaps?
Nope.
Not really. That's interesting. What do you think was the turning point? What made it suddenly appear?
Seaweed specifically?
Yeah, I guess seaweed, or, you know, if there's anything that you think is relevant that is upstream of that, then we can talk about that as well.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm originally from India. When I went to the States for undergrad, I studied biology and actually thought I was going to be an ecologist. So spent a lot of time doing some weird stuff. My first internship ever was actually scraping roadkill off of a highway in the Western Ghats in India, because I was doing like a research project there. So my whole life for 3 months was walking up and down the mountain and scraping roadkill off of the recording where the roadkill was killed and then scraping it off of the highway and just doing that over and over and over again. So that's kind of the life that I thought I was going to lead. And that took me to the Dominican Republic to do, again, some field work, but this time it was in the ocean. And I realized that I really wanted to do work in sustainability, oceans, climate change. So, and that was when I was 19. I think I feel pretty grateful and lucky to have sort of found my calling, if you will, at that age. So really, since I was 19, 20, I've been working on international climate and oceans issues, and I've been exploring it through various levers. You know, I always knew that this is a thing that I wanted to work on. I was just trying to figure out where I could make the most impact and change as a single human. So I explored the lever of policy. So I did a lot of work in think tanks. I explored the lever of academia. I worked in India, working on Indian, you know, climate adaptation issues. I got my master's in environmental management from Yale. Again, very wonky climate stuff. I worked in philanthropy. And I kind of discovered seaweed along the way. And I was like, this is the coolest systems level solution that I've come across and that I can think of. And my seaweed origin story was 2016. And I finally quit my job to start Rootless in 2020. So it had actually been like marinating in my mind for a couple of years.
Yeah, sometimes that's the case, right? You need to sort of, you come across things and they don't really click. And then other stuff happens, and all of a sudden you join the dots and you go, oh, that makes sense now.
Totally. I actually started to think about seaweed in the context of the methane reduction ability. So that was my entry point, and it just blew my mind. I mean, I read that big, you know, seminal 2015, 2016 paper that said that was doing the in vitro. You said I could go nerdy, so I'm going nerdy.
Absolutely.
Pull me back if you want me to give any specific context. But I read that paper that said that did the in vitro trials of seaweed's potential to reduce methane emissions from cow burps. And I was like, this is the coolest thing I have even come across. You know, the idea that you could build a carbon neutral, maybe even carbon negative dairy or beef supply chain was just a fascinating like systems solution idea to me. So that's actually the space that I started. And I kind of knew that I wanted to explore like entrepreneurship and like consumerism potentially and supply chains as a way to, as another lever, as a way to kind of build the seaweed economy. So that was my entry point. And I scoped it for a few years. I met like key players in the space, Davis and, you know, a couple of other kind of academics and practitioners. And I realized that was probably not the space for me to enter into, but that's kind of what led me down the nutrition profile rabbit hole for seaweed. And that was the thing where I was like, okay, let's go. I'm ready.
Let's dive into that then. There is, over 10,000 species of seaweed, possibly more. We know that they are some of the most nutrient-dense and diverse foods on the planet. But how much do you think we actually know about the composition and the health benefits of seaweed?
Not even vaguely enough. And that's
I'm sort of thinking particularly, you know, compared to how much we know about land vegetables.
I don't even think we know that much about land vegetables, to be honest. I think the sort of what I'm learning in doing this work is that the work and around food as medicine, you know, the actual kind of nutrition composition of food and why it is this power, why food really is medicine and is this powerhouse of nutrition and sort of the bioavailability, you know, utilizable nutrients in food. I think across the board, we don't know too much about it, but definitely for sea vegetables, we know even less. But I think it's really exciting to be in a space where you have seaweed has stood the test of time, right? I think unlike many, many things that are coming online in the like food tech and plant-based innovation space, this wasn't invented in a lab. It has literally been around since the beginning of time. I mean, there's all of these wild theories about how seaweed might have actually been the world's oldest food. It is debunking, you know, the theory of evolution, the way that we know it. The kelp highway theory. And to me, the fact that there's this like rich cultural historical legacy around eating seaweed both as food and as medicine, as a healing medicine in cultures around the world independently, you know, they weren't like talking to each other at the time. That to me is like the most validating thing. And the fact that the science is only just catching up now is, I think it's a great side effect. But I think that like the legacy of seaweed sort of speaks for itself.
Seaweed features in some of the so-called blue zones, which are regions around the world where people appear to live longer and healthier lives. What do you make of all of that?
I think it makes total sense. I mean, seaweed, as you said, is one of the most nutrient-dense and diverse foods on the planet. So a little nod to, you know, rootless, but the reason I love the storytelling aspect or, you know, that seaweed provides us is because it is a super concentrator of minerals because it doesn't have a root system. So in many ways, if you kind of think about this from a very specific perspective, like the nutrient uptake of a land plant is inhibited by the root system in some way. The nutrient uptake of seaweed is really not inhibited by a root system. So its rootlessness actually enables it to be a super concentrator of minerals in a way that nothing else really can. And there's also some really interesting work around the kind of antioxidizing, you know, the polyphenols, all the kind of good stuff that is fighting oxidative stress in your body when you consume seaweed. And if you think about it kind of logically, seaweed, lots of species of seaweed are found in zones of tumult and like volatility, you know, it's like wave breaks and it's not kind of a calm environment. And it is kind of physiologically found ways to build resiliency in its system. And that's the thing that you're eating. And that's the thing that's actually helping you access all of that, you know, kind of resilience, if you will. It makes total sense to me that seaweed is this powerhouse of nutrition. And, you know, it is sort of like at the bottom of the food chain in many ways too. So all the omega-3s that we're eating from the fish is really coming from the seaweed that's being bioaccumulated up the food chain. So it is not surprising to me at all that people who are eating seaweed, and I think this is the key bit, and this is the bit that we keep going back to as our, you know, blank, as our narrative blank. It's not just the occasional consumption of seaweed, it is a regular consumption of seaweed that's really leading to these reduced rates of metabolic syndrome disease in communities like Okinawa and Japan and Korea, who are eating seaweed every day. And I can, like, direct me if you want me to go into these papers, but I have so much research and studies around the Blue Zone diet and how the incidence of metabolic syndrome disease and the deaths due to metabolic syndrome disease are actually lower in Okinawa and Japan vis-a-vis the United States, for example.
Well, you read my mind, because I do know that you like to go deep into the science and the research about seaweed. And you jumped onto my next question, which is going to be about this. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, what are some of the most meaningful insights that have come out of recent papers, you know, around the health benefits of seaweed? Or anything that, you know, you found particularly exciting for whatever reason. So, yeah.
Oh, God.
Please, you know.
We will be talking for like 4 hours if I start to get into that.
We might have to do a two-parter.
Yeah, exactly. I think I'm a pretty curious person. Like, I love learning. And one of the things I love about seaweed is that, like, there's just so much to learn. Like, we truly just don't know anything. Like, we're really scratching the surface about, the scientific community, I think, is scratching the surface about why this thing is such a powerful source of nutrition. So I think some of the key ones, or at least I'm trying to think, the point at which I was like, I'm going to quit my job and become a traveling seaweed salesperson. You know, I'm kind of trying to think about the things that I was learning then that kind of solidified this pathway for me. So one, I think it is the nutrient density and diversity. And I said it's because, you know, it's like absorbing all of these minerals from its fronds and its sort of surface area. The second is that there's some really interesting research around, there's all kind of cultural storytelling around and historical storytelling around seaweed having antiviral, antimicrobial, anti-tumor properties. And the way that it shows up in the history and like mythology, for example, is that you would find people wrapping kelp fronds around tumors, and that would actually reduce the size of the tumors. Even today, there's this beautiful Korean tradition where just after a mother gives birth, the first meal that she has postpartum is a seaweed soup. And and it's still, you know, it's still practiced today. It's still going. And it's because it's sort of like replenishing all the stuff that your body has lost during this pretty traumatic, you know, event that your body went through. Now the science is catching up, you know. So now there's all of this research around how the bioactives in seaweed, or in certain species, for example, in the brown species, fucoidin and fucoxanthin specifically, are two big bioactives that the FDA and kind of pharma is looking at as potentially anti-carcinogenic.
For people that might not be familiar, how would we define a bioactive compound?
It is you might have to fact check me on this, but it's basically a phytonutrient. It's like something that is unique to a plant that performs some sort of like activates some kind of biological activity when it is consumed.
And so in seaweed, there's a few that are of particular interest that we know about at this stage.
Exactly. And I think the key thing is that we know about.
And that would be fucoidin,
fucoxanthin. And these are all polysaccharides. They're all basically compounds. But when consumed, and I think it's a regularity of consumption too, that's the key. It sort of has all of these healing properties in the human body. Porphyrin is another big one. Porphyrin is a fiber that is found in red seaweed. Actually, it's in the species that we use. It's found in nori. So there's lots of really interesting research that is now moving from, you know, in vitro to animal to hopefully human trials soon, that talks about how these things actually can be anti-carcinogenic, antiviral. I mean, pharma is entering the chat because there's all sort of, you know, if the research, you know, goes down the kind of clinical pathway and continues to show these promising results, like, you know, that could be the next sort of platform for drug discovery. I think it's a really interesting time to be working in and also contributing to the research in this space. Oh, and then one last thing, and this is a big part of our platform too, but I would say this was sort of a learning journey, and I'm still very much on that journey, the iodine in seaweed, which, as you know, is like a pretty hot topic in the health circles and in the seaweed world. The iodine in seaweed actually has a remarkable amount of protective qualities, and because it nourishes your thyroid, and I'm happy to talk more about that. But that is also one of the major kind of narrative education planks that we're focused on at Rootless.
Yeah, I think we can probably go a bit deeper some of these topics, because, you know, for me in particular, bioactive compounds is something that I find really interesting. And yeah, it does feel like we don't know a lot at the moment, but perhaps is where there is a lot of potential, you know, for the future of seaweed-based nutraceuticals. There's the iodine element for sure. So let's put it this way. If you had $1 million that you had to spend on scientific research, is there any substance or nutritional benefit of seaweed that you would want to find out more about?
Interesting. Oh, that's such a good question. Are you giving me $1 million?
We'll see at the end.
Okay. So this is an interview. I am really interested in seaweed's ability to impact women's health very specifically. We know that the iodine in seaweed is the most, it's bioavailable, you know, seaweed is the most natural potent source of iodine. We also know that in the U.S., really for the first time in recent history, we are iodine deficient as a country. There's a lot, it's particularly impacting women. There's a lot of subclinical thyroid issues that are in the population. And I believe the iodine from seaweed has the ability to nourish your thyroid and actually stabilize your body through major hormonal changes. This is what we're seeing start to show up in the research. And this is actually what we're seeing qualitatively, organically, and feedback from people who are eating our bites regularly. So I would love to invest in work around thyroid health and hormones. So like thyroid health, my hypothesis is that it actually stabilizes you during major hormonal transitions. So if I had $1 million, I would recruit like the most number of women to be on a seaweed trial where they're eating seaweed regularly and reporting on their hormonal imbalance symptoms, but particularly focused on perimenopause and postmenopause.
Why is that important? Focusing on that particular topic?
We know that menopause is the most underserved, least talked about sort of like thing that happens to every single woman. And there just isn't enough research on menopause. There is enough health research on women's health in general, but like menopause is just completely a white space. And every single woman or every single person with female biology is going to experience menopause, right? So it's this inevitability that's going to happen. 75% of women actually experience pretty debilitating menopausal symptoms. And, you know, to be quite crude, like the amount that it is for the economists out there, you know, the amount that it results in poor quality of life, lost working hours, reduced labor force, right? Like many women actually leave their jobs because the symptoms are too intense. So 1 billion women by 2025 are going to be experiencing menopause. You know, that is a huge amount of people in this world. And I would love to do more research around how, you know, plant-based medicine, iodine, thyroid, and iodine from seaweed specifically impacts women who are experiencing this.
No, absolutely. Do you think, I mean, I'm obviously not asking you to make anything up. I think we're going to have to spend $1 million and see what happens. But do you think there may be a difference between seaweed consumption, which will include iodine, you know, and taking, say, iodine as a supplement, just that?
100%. And there's some interesting research to show this as well. Like, and this is kind of going back to like population level data, going into cultures and researching and understanding why women, for example, in postmenopausal women in Korea, for example, have less incidence of breast cancer. Lots of people have actually attributed the menopause is kind of a, it's a big topic. There's just so much stuff in there. The hormones basically regulate like everything that's happening in your body, right? So if your major sex hormones are actually declining over a period of time, your everything is in chaos. And there's over 40 symptoms of menopause. After menopause, you're actually more prone to, and estrogen is protective, right? So after the estrogen sort of levels decline in your body, your risk of breast cancer, of osteoporosis, of all of these kind of, you know, larger sort of diseases increases. But when you look at women who are eating, you know, in the blue zones, for example, or in parts of East Asia, where seaweed is a big part of their diet and soy is a big part of their diet, there's the sort of theory was that soy is actually protective in some way because it's a phytoestrogen, I believe. And there's now kind of new research to disentangle the fact that it could be soy, but it could actually also be seaweed. And if you think about how, you know, traditionally you eat seaweed, one way would be like a miso soup. So that would be, you're getting your broth of all of that nutrient dense seaweedy nutrition. You're eating a little bit of seaweed, so you're not overloading on iodine. You're eating soy in the form of tofu. So there's something about sort of like the complementarity of that food that's also leading to all of these changes. You know, there's also research to show that when Korean or Japanese people are adopting the Western diet, the incidence of metabolic syndrome disease is actually increasing back up. So there's something about diet, really, truly, that is, and even the style of eating, right? That like 80-20 principle where you're only eating up to 80% of your like hunger level, I guess. So that's one piece. And then the second piece is that there is nothing, no amount of science and AI and generative AI in this world and sophistication and technology that can recreate the nutrition of food in one swoop. Like, it's not possible. So the way that your body utilizes iodine from seaweed is actually different from the way that your body utilizes iodine from potassium iodide or, you know, an iodine supplement, because it has all of the other stuff to go with it. You know, there's a little bit of selenium, there's a little bit of magnesium, there's macro and micronutrients. So
I wonder if there's any research about the way it is absorbed when it's linked with all the other, with seaweed, when it's being absorbed with seaweed and all the other compounds versus when it's a synthesized, you know, or isolated form.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know if you've come across anything on, you know, in that area.
There is some research around it. The problem with bioavailability studies is that it's so individualistic, you know, so it's actually pretty hard to do like what they call bio, and it's very expensive, because I've always wanted to do a bioavailability study actually to see how much like uptake, how your body is utilizing the iodine from seaweed or just even the nutrition in seaweed. We know that it's more bioavailable, we just don't know how much. And if there's 12,000 species of seaweed and all of them have different levels of iodine and all of them have slightly different nutrition profiles, all of them have different bioavailability in your body too.
Yeah. And well, I guess what we don't know is the interaction with other compounds that might be in some way complementary.
Exactly.
Yeah. Going back to the bioactive compounds, what else do we know, or do we know anything else about fucoidins and fucoxanthin?
Those two compounds specifically are being studied for cancer. That is the big kind of, you know, research, body of research around it. I feel like the train has left the tracks there. You know, pharma's probably going to come in. There's likely going to be more clinicals and more information is coming out. So I feel like that world is sort of set, and I'm keeping track of it. But, you know, we know that there's something around those bioactives in cancer, and it'll be interesting to see how it sort of shows up in all of these different industries. The thing I'm interested in is porphyrin specifically, because Nori is, you know, a big part of, I think Nori, actually, I don't know this for sure, so we'll have to fact check this, but I think Nori is probably, I hypothesize, Nori is probably the most consumed seaweed in the world. Maybe.
It sounds believable, but yeah, we can fact check it after this.
We'll fact check it. I think in Japan a couple of years ago, it was just Nori was a $2 billion industry. So it's pretty big. And Nori, some species, the porphyra species specifically have porphyrin, which is a prebiotic fiber. It's a bioactive and also a prebiotic fiber, which has actually in vitro been shown to kill colon cancer cells. So, and I can send you this article, it's pretty interesting. And I'm really curious to learn more or to do more research or invested more research in some with my $1 million in like the fiber component of seaweed. You know, because we all know that there's insoluble fiber, there's soluble fiber. Seaweed is also, this is a bit much, but because seaweed like absorbs water and moisture, when it's moving through your body, it's actually like, it's bulking up your fecal matter. So one of the big, you know, pieces of feedback that we hear is, regular consumption of the bites, we use powdered seaweed, actually helps with like regularity. So people are pooping better and more frequently. And between the thyroid and the gut, these are two massive, you know, underserved problems that we need to solve, I think, at the population level. So I'm pretty excited about research around that too.
Yeah, exciting times. We'll have to wait and see what comes up.
Totally.
Okay, this is going to be where I zoom out again and talk about entrepreneurship, which I know is another topic that probably for both of us is quite important. And entrepreneurship is, I guess, you could define it as spotting a gap in the market, solving a problem. I've heard the analogy a few times between entrepreneurship and finding the key for a lock, where the lock represents a problem, an unmet need or a pain point that exists in the market, and the key is the idea or solution. But I do think that many seaweed entrepreneurs must have felt at some point as if they were running around with a key, i.e. seaweed, desperately looking for a lock that it could open. Have you ever felt this way?
Every day. you have so eloquently articulated the existential crisis of my life right now. So I mean, yes,
that makes two
always.
Of us. So
what do you think about, like, what is the lock for you, you think?
The problem really is that you really want seaweed to be the key, because I guess many of us recognize that it's a really cool industry, a really cool set of solutions. And you want those solutions, you want to find a way to apply those solutions. And I think a lot of the locks are no-brainers, but are also not very profitable, for lack of a better expression, because a lot of the solutions are environmental solutions. And, you know, if we think about climate change or replacing bioplastic with biomaterials and so on, they're all, and this is going to be a massive generalization, but a lot of these solutions don't pay by themselves. There is no, other than carbon credits and nutrient credits, which can get quite difficult and quite controversial, there is nothing that pays for doing direct good to the planet.
That's so true. It's so
and
true.
I think this is quite widespread to any sort of impact entrepreneur or entrepreneur looking to get into sustainability. It doesn't, you know, we could look at outside seaweed as well. You know, anybody that's trying to start up a company that will do something for the planet, you know, something within the sustainability space, they will have the same problem. And I think, you know, somebody like yourself and myself, we fell in love with seaweed at some point. We decided we were going to spend our time working on this, you know, in this industry. But and I think the difficulty for me is, how do we reverse engineer a problem where you want seaweed to be the solution, right? There's potentially a lot. And I think what is going to be the skill there for a lot of entrepreneurs like yourself is to find an interesting way to do that and find a way to use seaweed, to use this untapped potential of seaweed in a way that not only does good for the planet, it could be socially, it could be health. That's why we're here today. You know, it's because, you know, it's such an important piece of the puzzle, which personally I am trying to sort of learn more about. But at the same time, we're going to have to make a profitable business. So I'd be really curious to hear how you approach that sort of dilemma and how you went about it.
Thank you for sharing. And I have to say, like, that is exactly how I feel. That's exactly how I felt, especially in this sort of like exploration journey as I was navigating, you know, which lever of which theory of change to invest my time, energy, passion into. And I landed on like consumerism. You know, I was like, what? And that's the theory of change. I mean, I'm trying to figure out, and this is what we're trying to do with the company, which is, how do we make this thing sexy? You know, like, people are spending so much money on stuff, on just stuff. If we can actually leverage consumerism, consumer spending, capitalism, all of that, if we can leverage the system, and I'm not saying this judgmentally, like, I live in that system. If we can leverage that system to really create value in that sustainable supply chain and do all of the stuff that we have to do on the back end to ensure that the seaweed is sustainably sourced, regeneratively harvested, cultivated, etc., that could be, you know, one way to make more profitable, lasting, sustainable change in the world versus, you know, nonprofits or think tanks or academia. And I think you need all of it, but that's kind of the space that I chose. And I have to say, it has been a really humbling and fascinating journey over the last now 3.5 years because I went in. So that was the theory of change. The theory of change was like, let's make this thing sexy. Let's put brand into it. I don't want you to be eating this because you think that this is helping the environment. I want you to be eating this because it's actually helping you. Like, that was the consumer problem that I was trying to solve. Like, and everyone knows I love seaweed. I love everything about her. She surprises me every day. I learn so much from her. And not a lot of people like the taste of seaweed. I mean, I think we're just, and there's this like perception about seaweed that I think we all need to change, which is like, it's smelly, it's on the beach, it's ruining my beach vacation. Or I think in the West, there's like, it's foreign, you know, it's an alien thing, which is completely fair because it hasn't been part of, you know, the Western diet and that like cultural traditional way. So I actually wanted to develop both a product and a brand identity that was not seaweedy. So, and I'm sure you've noticed, like, if you go to our website or, you know, interact with any of our materials, like, it's not a blue-green brand, you know, it is, like, chic. And, you know, I'm manifesting that, like, Gwyneth Paltrow and Goop will, like, pick us up one day. Like, it's like this, it's a women's health supplement. And that's the thing that I always knew that I wanted to do. And even when we were building sort of, like, the brand foundation and identity, one of the big existential questions we had was, is this a seaweed company selling a health product, or is this a health company selling a seaweed product?
I like that.
I was coming from like the impact world. You know, I went in with, this is a seaweed company selling a health product. So I would say probably for the first 2 years, even the way that I would introduce myself, I would say I run a seaweed company. While the brand identity is not very seaweed heavy, like, it does show up in places, and, you know, all of our messaging and ads and education was like, seaweed is healthy for you. This is just an easy way for you to eat it every day. I thought that that was going to be our lock. I think over the last, like, I would say 6 or 7 months, we've realized that that is not the lock. So what has now happened over the last couple of months, which is why this is also just such a fun time to have this conversation, is we're now a women's health company, or even like a hormone health company that's powered by seaweed. So our entire sort of identity has changed. And the way that I introduce myself has changed. Now I say I run like a femtech company, a women's health company. And that's, in my opinion, the way to reach the most number of people in the least amount of time with the lowest amount of money. So let's see.
Very interesting. I really admire that, because I think it's a very difficult switch to make.
Totally.
It's very difficult not to get stuck on, I'm a seaweed company and I need to find a problem. Well done for doing that. Okay, so that was the original idea, and now you sort of morphed into what Rootless is today, i.e. a hormone company. Correct me if I'm wrong. You touched on a few points already. I wanted to really understand, what was the process that you went through from the original idea to the point where you launched the product? Some of these points you've already explained, but is there more about, could you take us through the story? You feel free to go into detail. I'd really like to understand, for example, if there was any milestone or important decision that you had to take or that you took, and how you got to the product that Rootless is selling today.
Yeah, great question. It's interesting because I feel like the product has not actually changed very much. It's gotten better, you know, as it should, but the core principles of product design has not changed over the years. The brand identity has changed, or brand positioning has changed. I would say the brand identity has changed. So I was building the brand around a few principles that I had shared. But kind of nested within that, I wanted to build a product that was the everyday, no big deal, everyday consumption of seaweed, where regardless of whether you like the taste of seaweed or not, you could access the health benefits.
Okay, so the original idea was to make a daily product that would appeal to people whether they like seaweed or not.
Correct. And I wanted it to be food, not a supplement. I wanted it to be regenerative seaweed, and I wanted it to taste good.
I have to say, I've been looking at your website before we got in touch. And one thing that I really liked was that you seem to have tapped into what is an existing habit. Am I making this up, or was there some thought around? Because you mentioned daily.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything more there in terms of wanting to tap into a habit?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you think that we've tapped into that. That's the goal. I mean, but I think unlike the reason that this has been that this is and will continue to be a challenging form factor to work with is because we have to build a habit. So if you integrate it into your life and you're eating it regularly, you do actually feel the benefits. And we did this, we couldn't afford to do a clinical, but we did like what we consider to be the closest to a clinical study where we, I can tell you more about that. But once we get you in the funnel, we really try to kind of push you towards creating like a ritual, or not even a habit, but like a ritual around this thing that you know you're doing for yourself and you know you're doing for your health. And the way that I like to talk about it is like habit stacking, you know? So it's like, if you already have your coffee in the morning or your smoothie, or you like to work out, whatever you're doing every day, just like add this on. And there's different narrative ways to do that. And I don't think we're sort of like, we have nailed exactly what it is. And I think that's kind of beautiful too. Like, I appreciate when people kind of come to me and they're like, oh, I you know, have replaced my afternoon cup of coffee, or, you know, I do it before yoga. Or I kind of like the sort of like flex that it allows you. And I like learning how people integrate it into their days. But I think that scale comes with habit stacking onto something that is like more common. So coffee, I would say, is a big one. But we do know that mornings are like a big time where people take their bites and enjoy them.
Yeah. So two things. One thing was maybe at this point, it would be good to explain what the product is and what Daily Bite is. And also to add on to what you just said, I think not only habit stacking, but I think also a habit replacement.
Okay.
It's definitely the first thing that came to mind when I saw your product was like, oh yeah, I have a bit of dark chocolate after lunch, and that's my treat. If my dark chocolate, my treat, you know, had seaweed in it, and it was.
Oh, look at that product placement!
There you go. There you go.
It's the chocolate flavor too.
There you go. So that's replacing an existing habit that.
Totally.
In my personal case, not to make it about myself, but it's something that's already there. Like what I'm doing is just replacing it with something that is functional food rather than just a treat.
Totally. We need to get you some bites because that's perfect. Like that's exactly it. And we do actually have a cacao flavor that I think does swap out. You know, it's either like with your coffee, you need something quick, you swap out your cookie with that. Like my parents are, where I'm Indian, and my parents drink chai in the morning, and my dad actually swaps out his like cookie with the bites. And the product is a date, almond, seed, and seaweed bite. You would eat one a day as you would like a supplement or a multivitamin. Get that super potent hit of nutrition. It gives you, we've done some pretty extensive nutrition profiling. There's over 40 macro micronutrients. It gives you a daily dose of iodine, which, as we know, as we were talking about, you know, is not as much a part of the food system anymore. And it has prebiotic fiber in there. It has all of those bioactives, the porphyrin specifically. And, you know, it helps you be more energized. It helps regulate your gut health. So it helps you go to the bathroom more. And I think the thing that honestly surprised me and the thing that we're leaning into is this hormone health piece, because it is actually helping women navigate menopause and perimenopause, which is really just like a wild time in a woman's life, because your body is like screaming at you. It's really going through some chaotic transitions. It actually helps you sort of stabilize during that time. So sometimes and it's different for different women, but like for some women, it's actually completely stopped their night sweats or their hot flashes. It gives them more energy. And I think the thing that, to your point, the thing that we need to continuously sort of push on is, this is not a pill. And it's actually, and you know, it's food is medicine, so it's more bioavailable, but it's actually like a wellness ritual or a health ritual you can enjoy. You know, so it's like, even if it's a 2-minute thing that where you're taking 2 minutes to yourself every day and you're just savoring your bite and you're doing something you know is good for you, that's like a well-being story. And that's the thing that actually comes up in feedback. You know, people are like, I had this one woman who was like, thank you for being a small assurance in a chaotic world. I have this one customer who likes to take her bite first thing in the morning with her daughter. There's this one woman who likes to take her bite with her spouse. I think she's like in her 60s. It's just like, I would love to live in this world where A, food is medicine, but B, doing something for your health is like enjoyable and it's something you look forward to.
Yeah. Is that what's behind your decision to not go with other formats?
Yeah.
Say a capsule or, you know, any other sort of, yeah. So not wanting to make a medicine rather, you know.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I will say today, like this is the decision we made today. And I have found over the last three years that, because we've been on the market for about 2 years, that there's a lot of explanation. Like the burden of education for this product is so high because it's what is effectively a new ingredient. And there's a lot of perception around the ingredient, right? So you either introduce someone to it or you have to like reframe it in someone's mind. So that's hard. It's a new form factor. So people are like, what is this? Do I eat it in one bite? What does it replace? Why can I only have one? So there's just like, and the fact that like food nutrition is more bioavailable and better for your body than supplement nutrition. So for now, this is the decision we've made and this is the sort of education that we're doing.
Was there any surprise? Like you mentioned people using the product in certain ways, people finding certain benefits, namely menopause-related sort of health benefits. Was there any surprise in there that you maybe didn't know when you launched the product and then you realize, oh, we're actually opening more than one lock and we didn't think about it, we didn't expect it?
100%. I think the big one has been the iodine and the thyroid. And that's also been such a huge learning journey for me. You know, like I did not know what the thyroid does in your body. It is, so the thyroid, it's this butterfly-shaped organ in your throat, like in your neck area. And it produces T3 and T4 hormones, which every single cell in your body uses to utilize energy. So the thyroid is how we describe it, is the thyroid is the master battery of your body. It literally, like the proper functioning of your thyroid literally makes your body tick. And the way that the thyroid makes the hormones, the thyroid hormones, is with dietary iodine. So if you're not eating enough iodine, because your body doesn't make iodine, if you're not eating enough iodine or supplementing enough iodine, your body is actually not making hormones that it needs to regulate your metabolism, regulate your energy levels, anything, right? Like any organ is functioning less optimally than it should be. And I think the very interesting thing that I've learned in this journey is that for the first time in recent history, we are iodine deficient in the West. Actually, a lot of this work is being done in the UK as well. But particularly in the US, because we're not using iodized salt as much anymore in our diets and even more so if you're plant-based and you're not eating like seafood and seaweed regularly, there's a very high likelihood that you're iodine deficient. And iodine deficiency, the way that it manifests is higher chances of infertility, higher rates of miscarriage. Iodine deficiency is the leading cause of cognitive developmental issues and like brain damage in children. Iodine is critical. Like it's one of the most critical things that a mother needs to eat in her like like pregnancy journey, so either like fertility or pregnancy, postpartum, your iodine needs as a woman, as a pregnant woman and as a postpartum woman actually go up, because that's the only way for your child to get iodine. And iodine is what cognitively develops your brain. So it just all of this work has made me come to the realization, learn so much more about like the importance of iodine in the Western, not just in the Western diet, but I think particularly in the Western diet, because we're just not talking about it enough.
And interestingly, for plant-based diets.
Exactly.
There's so many things, so many ways we could, we could go from here. Do you, obviously a lot of people will be listening to this audio only, although you can watch it on YouTube as well. Can we, because you mentioned this is a format that a lot of people are not familiar with. There's probably a lot of people that will ask you, you know, what is it? I've never seen this before. It's not a pill. It's not a, you know, a sort of whole food. It's not a tablet. What, you know, it's not a shake or a drink. So what does it look like? How big is it? You know, there you go.
So it's 10.5 grams, and it's kind of like an energy bite. It's like a little energy cube. 45 calories, no added sugar. I mean, the carrier is dates and almonds. So I would say it tastes a little bit like a date bar, like a Lara bar or RX bar or something. And we have 5 labels.
Did you consider other formats, or did you test any other versions of the product at the beginning?
Oh God, this is like what every entrepreneur tells you to do, but I did not. I was just, this is the thing I wanted to do. I remember when I just was fooling around in my brother and I were in his kitchen, and we were just like fooling around. We were like, oh, what about this? What about that? And I wanted to make it beautiful. I wanted to make it taste good. And I wanted to have it like be food as medicine. And actually the scratch recipe, I can even send you a photo of what the first bite was. The scratch recipe was, I would say, like 75% of what the final commercialized recipe was.
That is so rare.
It's rare. And I think to your point, it's like I sometimes wistfully and to be very candid, envious of founders who have found the lock. You know, they're like, I saw this gap in the market and I wanted to fix it. Like, I knew that the world needed more vegan something or the other. I don't know. Or allergen free cookies. And this is the product that I went to make. I envy that, because this is, and not to say that that's easier in any way, but the burden of education is high, you know, and there's been a lot of, and there will continue to be a lot of just like trial and error and testing. And I think we finally come to a place where we found our lock, but it's really hard to, in that 3-second window you have with a consumer or with a person online or via ads or, you know, whatever digital marketing you're doing, it's very difficult to distill what the value prop of this product is in 3 seconds. So yeah, that's our challenge.
Yeah. So perhaps where you have done, still are doing a lot of testing is on the positioning and the, you know, the education piece and the public perception and all of that sort of stuff.
Exactly. And my goal with this work is, let's say 5 years, the way that you think about, you know, kombucha and gut health and turmeric and immunity or anti-inflammatory and mushrooms and cognition. I think we have this opportunity where like seaweed is to X. And I think that X is hormones. So that's the kind of message that we just need to keep building, because I think the market opens up a little bit more when you're thinking about something that's like that high level, because, or a health benefit that is that high level, because our TAM is literally like every woman, you know, like this could really help. Seaweed could help you. Even the Korean, you know, tradition around myeonggukk, the seaweed soup, it is a postpartum soup. Like, it actually replenishes your body with all of this stuff, right? So our big dream is like, we want to create products for women going through all parts of their hormonal journey. So puberty and PCOS and postpartum and pregnancy and perimenopause and menopause. And perimenopause and menopause is sort of like the entry point.
One of the reasons I asked you about the format is because it is unusual. And I was sort of wondering, from a purely sort of manufacturing perspective, let's go back to your kitchen. You have your initial recipe. You're sort of trying a few different things, but actually you land on something you like pretty quickly. And it looks like a little cube. Mm-hmm. And now you have to produce it at scale, at least more than what is a very small scale kitchen product. How does that work with something that it is not a capsule, it's not a tablet, it's not a bar? Did you, I'm assuming you use a co-packer or contract manufacturer. How did that journey, was that a challenge?
Oh God, yes.
Sorry to bring up
PTSD.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a challenge. It was a challenge, but I will say it was, and we also have these, we have these like tins that the product comes with. So you would get like these two packs, which is a month's supply, and a tin. And the idea is you put your tin somewhere that you could see it, you know, so it actually gives you that like visual. And it's a beautiful, like little beautiful box. So you would put it somewhere that you could see it, and that would be your cue to eat it. To eat it daily.
Due to the habit.
Exactly. So like from literally the time of my quitting my job, and I, at that point I didn't have any idea, any clue what I was gonna do. I just knew I wanted to do seaweed. And I have to say, like, the sort of like it was, my parents were just like so supportive, and so that was really, I think I went into it with a lot of naivety and a lot of support, which I feel very grateful for. But from the time of quitting and even just trying to like put the idea on paper to launch was about a year. And this was literally in the middle of COVID. So 2020, we launched, like did our first ever beta pilot run, just friends and family, in November of 2021. And it was bang in the middle of the supply chain crisis. So all of our stuff got stuck. Everything was delayed. I have lost, I think, years of my life in that 1 year of launch. And I was doing a bit of it myself. And then we started to hire a team towards the end of 2021. The reason I laughed is because we had this incredible small co-manufacturing facility in Anaheim that we worked with. And she was... this amazing woman. She's BIPOC, also half Japanese. And it was hard to find somebody who would want to work with seaweed. You know, it's like not even though we work with powdered seaweed, not a lot of people wanted to work with us. And we found her. She was amazing. She didn't, like, one of the big challenges with the contract manufacturing world is MOQs, right? Like you have to hit a certain scale and volume for them to even want to partner with you. And I think for a small brand, even till today, no one wants to commit to those MOQs because you have just a lot of, because you're still learning, right? You're still like building the product. So there were many reasons why it was like a great first step. She didn't have MOQs. There was a lot of flexibility. She was a really amazing partner. And we were, this is hilarious, we were making the bites by hand. So we didn't have a machine. So we actually were all like on the line making bites by hand. And there's 30 bites per pack, right?
So that's a lot of bites.
It's a lot of bites. And it was a lot of people just like in the kitchen making them by hand. I was on the line for like, you know, I would go down to Anaheim once a month to do our production. I was on the line making bites. I was on the line packing stuff. And your hands cramp. And I don't know if it's like a... I think back to those times wistfully.
Definitely, yeah. So was this a bit more than a commercial kitchen, but a bit less than a
exactly
manufacturing sort of plant?
That's a really good way to put it. But I think the really beautiful thing that came out of that, in addition to hand cramps, was we learned so much about our product. Like I knew, and my ops lead, we knew exactly what the problems were, and therefore we actually were able to troubleshoot in a way that you can't when you outsource manufacturing to somebody else, right? Because you're not actually on the line to see what happens. So I think it actually got us to this place where learned blah, 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 et cetera. Well, lots of costs were like the cost of manufacturing was insane. I can't even think about that. But it got us to a place where we actually developed these very sophisticated SOBs. And I'm blanking on what SOBs stand for.
Standard operating procedure.
Exactly. And so we landed on these really sophisticated SOBs that then we could take to a larger co-manufacturing facility. And like ease into, you know, being using a machine. So we use an extruder with our product and are able to make like our scale, our ability to scale now is significantly greater. And then a lot of changes with the packaging and all of that. So we're in a good place now. And I think there's a lot more that needs to be done in kind of operational efficiency, but we're at that place where it's now efficiency, you know, which is cool.
At that point where you were at a smaller scale, were you testing the product at farmers markets, dinner parties, fill in the blank, to see that, you know, to validate that there was actually an audience for this?
We actually went direct to consumer. So as soon as we started to produce, we started to sell online. And for the first year, so we launched, you know, really to the public in 2022, January. And for the first year, maybe 8 or 9 months, we didn't do a lot of like paid advertising. We were doing more like organic marketing and partnerships and getting into the hands of influencers and influential people and affiliates and all of that good stuff. Lots of sampling events. But online was like direct to consumer was our primary sort of platform for distribution. Later in the year, and we're a subscription product, so I think what interestingly started to happen was, you know, when you're not spending a lot of money on Facebook or you don't have large acquisition channels, our top of funnel growth was kind of slow, but our churn was really low. Like when people subscribed, they would stay for months and months and months and months. And in November of 2022, I actually did this big interview series with a lot of my subscribers, like anyone who would talk to me, where I spent like between 45 minutes to an hour with them. And I was just like, I want to know your experience, whether they've joined, whether they're still with us. And I think that was the moment of validation for me, because the kind of feedback that we got in that process was just like beyond genuinely like my wildest dreams. And that was the point I was like, we really have something here. And that was when all of the iodine stuff was also coming, crystallizing a little bit. And then, you know, Q4 of 2022 is when we really started to move on marketing and started to like more aggressively advertise on Facebook and do all of that. And that's when we started to hit like a certain level of scale.
But there was essentially a good year and a half where you were working on this thing, on production as well, not really knowing how it would land.
Totally. And you know, I think a part of it is, I think we're still in that space. Like we still need to find a way that I say we have found product market fit at more at the bottom of the funnel. You know, it's like when people get it, they get it and they stay. So our lifetime value is really high. We have just loyal consumers, you know, like we just 5 days ago launched our big crowdfunding campaign that I would love to send you a link to. And we are trying to raise about $1 million, 1.2. And we did like a little test the waters campaign in December of last year, where we just went out to our organic lists and our subscribers and our consumers. And we were like, you know, this is your opportunity really to like become a shareholder in Ruthless and invest in the future of food, future of human and planetary health. And we got $600,000 in reservations. So I'm hoping that some of that will convert into actual investment. But we were like, this is cool because people are actually willing to put their money where their mouths are. And LOL. And we have people who have already bought, you know, $500, $600 worth of product via subscription with us. So we're just like, just invest that into the company and you can become a shareholder and actually help us build this thing, which would be awesome.
Absolutely. When is the crowdfunding campaign happening and where?
It's live. It's on our website.
Mm-hmm. And when is it going to close?
I think end of May is what we're hoping.
Okay, so this episode is very likely to go out in April, so hopefully people will still have time.
Okay, that would be awesome.
Maybe it'll be good to have, yes, first of all, the link, so we can put it in the show notes for people to go and have a look, and maybe an exact date so that we can, you know, coordinate.
That would be awesome.
The publishing of the episode. Because, you know, I'm sure a lot of people, there's a lot of seaweed advocates that listen to this. And I'm sure people will be interested and, you know, quite happy to have a look, you know, and contribute. So that'd be cool. I'm going to zoom out again. That was really, really cool, really interesting. Thanks for going such level of detail. I wanted to talk about trends. trends in the sort of health space. What are some of the trends that you have identified so far in health, and I suppose health and well-being, where seaweed is or could become a compelling solution?
Menopause. That's the thing. I really feel like that's the next big thing in women's health, as it should be. But the early research is suggesting that, so in terms of TAM, you know, a billion women experiencing menopause by 2025, women now spend over 40% of their lives navigating postmenopause. It's a $600 billion market opportunity, again, by 2025. And no one is talking to this woman. And I've been in these rooms. I'm both a seaweed salesman, but also like a menopause advocate. I'm going to menopause conferences. That's where we're sampling our bites. Like, that's the woman that we have found product market fit with. She is hungry for solutions. She is hungry for information. She's a pretty discerning consumer. So you can't BS her, really. Like, she really knows what she wants. She's not here for snake oil solutions, and it's untapped. No, I really don't think a lot of brands or companies are talking to her. So, and I think menopause is one piece, but the larger trend is hormones and hormone balancing, which is a little bit it's a little bit technical, but technically you can't balance your hormones because they're always moving around, when you're having your cycle, outside of menstruation, etc. But I think hormones is a key lock for the women's health movement is really gonna, is going to be the thing for the next decade, I hope. So I'm really excited about that.
You find that people are now starting to pay attention to this area?
Exactly. And I think it's at that systems level, So the White House has just invested $1 billion, $100 million, actually, not really, $100 million in women's health. Celebrities are talking about it. I actually have Oprah wrote her entire magazine issues about menopause. So it's happening. There's a wave.
I'm going to go back to something you said earlier, which is storytelling. And seaweed is great for storytelling. You mentioned the history, there's the folklore, the mythology, the link to human evolution, the connection with the ocean, and sustainability, which, although it might not be a selling point sometimes, it is an element of, fascination and definitely the, storytelling. How do you think about the data story and building credibility? Because when talking about health benefits of your product and seaweed in general, what has been your approach to explaining that seaweed is serious, is a serious health product, not snake oil?
It's a good question. I think that will continue to be one of our challenges. I find a lot of credibility and validation in things that actually last. I think time truly is the most validating thing we have as humans. If something has stood the test of time, there probably is a reason. And I like telling stories that are holistic. So I like to, when I'm talking about the health benefits of seaweed, I like to talk about the cultural and historical, legacy around it. I like to talk about how it shows up in mythology. I like to tell those stories as sort of the entry point. I like to tell the stories about the actual science that is being done now, around dosage, around bioactives, around polyphenols, around the fiber. And then I think there's a really interesting storytelling around population level data as well. So what we talked about, how it shows up in blue zones, how population level data actually suggests that there's less metabolic syndrome disease, how population level data also suggests that when communities adopt the Western diet, that can change. And then I think finally, I also like to be honest about forthcoming about the fact that we don't know everything yet, and we likely never will. But this is definitely something that's more good than bad. And I think one thing that's really worth mentioning too is seaweed is one of the big things about iodine, and why iodine is a Goldilocks nutrient in your body is because you can actually eat too much iodine. And several species, especially actually brown species, so all the kelp species, are super, super concentrators of iodine. So when I was experimenting with species inclusion in our product, if I used kelp, we would be at 2,000% of your daily value versus 100% or 120% of your daily value. And if you have some kind of thyroid issues, which again, subclinical, the Western medical system writ large, it's a bit generalization, but it's not testing for thyroid issues. If you eat too much seaweed, you could actually throw your thyroid out of whack. So you it is actually one of those true like Goldilocks, like eat in moderation kind of foods as everything is. But it's more good than bad. Like it's filling gaps in the Western diet. It is providing you with all of this nutrition that you're likely not getting. It's heavy in iodine. It has all of these bioactives and polyphenols. And while the science is catching up, like it's just going to make you feel better. So that's the amount of information I have today. I do want to do a clinical. So that's what I'm hoping that we could use some of the funds for and just like contribute to that body of research, right?
Are there any requirements in terms of proving the health claims, which I guess takes me to a wider question, which could be, it might be very difficult to address in just a few minutes, but have you faced any challenges in doing that or maybe more in general in regulations, you know, nutraceuticals?
So we do have a nutrition facts panel. So we are regulated technically under the FDA as food, and it is the way that the food and the supplement industry is regulated in the US is not particularly stringent. So you get into trouble if something bad happens, basically. So you don't have to like run anything by anyone before you're announcing something or you're putting something out onto the market. And this is super technical, but like the product claims that you can make really need to be tied to your nutrients, you know? So if you have, like if you have over 20% of certain nutrients in your, on your nutrition facts panel, micronutrients, and then I forget what it is for the macros, you can start to say things like sugar-free or, you know, whatever it is. There are definitely like regulations and restrictions that you need to walk around. And I have found that, and we did a consumer trial actually, where we recruited 36 women, 34 of whom were over 40, and we had them be on the protocol. So they ate like a bite every day for 4 weeks and reported on their hormonal imbalance symptoms. Literally 100% of them felt less severe, less frequent, or completely stopped feeling the symptoms that they came in with. And then we bucketed them in kind of large categories. One of them was energy metabolism, one of them, and fatigue. One of them was gut, and one of them was hormonal dryness and hormonal acne. So now that we know sort of directionally, this is where we, how the product is helping people, I want to do a clinical. Because the truth is that like, especially as you're moving into, you know, like working with doctors, and like my dream is that at every OBGYN clinic, at every menopause clinic, you have, you know, your doctor talking to you. Even if it's not about us, your doctor's talking to you about iodine, your doctor's talking to you about your thyroid. Hopefully your doctor's prescribing you seaweed as part of your supplement regime. But I will say, to get into the Western medical system, you need to have credibility in that space. So a clinical feels like the next step. But I mean, it's expensive. And for a small brand to access, it's a lot.
In that case, you go out of the food and functional food space and you go more into the medical area?
We would still be a food.
You still be a food. And as a food, you can say it helps regulating your hormones based on the fact that there is iodine and you don't have to, there's no requirements in terms of how much iodine you need to contain or anything like that.
We can even say that now because we have over 20%. So we have like 120% actually of the daily iodine that you need. And I am very intentional about the amount of iodine that's in the product. So I'm not giving you more than you need every day. It's like for pregnant women, actually, they can eat 2 of the bites per day. But we've also limited like usage so that you're not eating, you know, the full bag because that would actually be too much iodine.
Yeah. Okay. Look, as we start to bring this to a close, do you have any resources, I'm thinking books, blogs, anything at all, for people who might want to find out more about seaweed and health?
We are doing a lot of writing and educating. So we have like a pretty extensive resource on our website, and I could send you the link to that. We have a blog that talks about capturing everything that we've talked about, you know, the seaweed's impact on bone health, seaweed's impact on hormones, seaweed's impact on thyroid health. So we have a blog post that covers that. We have a blog post specifically that talks about seaweed, iodine, thyroid, and menopause. We have one more specifically on iodine and thyroid. I'm like swimming in research and textbooks. One of my favorite textbooks is written by this academic from Denmark. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I think it's Ole Mauritzen. I can send you the link to it so you have it.
Yeah, if you could, please. Yeah, and we'll put everything in the show notes.
Every person I hire or I work with, I buy them that textbook.
Okay.
It's amazing.
It's got to be good. Are you going to any interesting conference or event about seaweed and health or anything around that?
We are doing events all the time. So how we split it up in my, so I have two amazing team members. One is, and I think you might have even met her actually, she was at the Secret Culture conference last year. So Gabby goes to she's our supply chain and seaweed expert and ops and product lead. So she goes to the seaweed related conferences. So we'll probably be at Secret Culture again. She'll do more of the kind of seaweed industry conferences. And then my other employee, who is also named Gabby, who's our chief of staff, is actually a doctor in traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture. So she's pretty deep into like women's health and fertility and kind of food as medicine, nutrition. Her and I kind of switch off in the events that we go to. So we do a lot of menopause events. We do a lot of nutritionist events. Actually, we're going to one at the end of April, where we're going to have a little booth and we're going to talk about seaweed's impact. We're going to actually like teach the nutritionists about it so that they can teach, you know, their patients and colleagues about thyroid and seaweed and iodine. So we'll do a lot of education. Anywhere we have to show up, we show up.
I was going to mention, because it's one that I know about, which is Seaweed for Health. It's going to be in Cork, Ireland on the 22nd, 23rd and 24th of May. I'm going to be there.
Oh,
so if anybody is around, it'll be a great opportunity to catch up and, you know, talk more about these topics.
I love it.
And we'll put all of that, you know, all of these details in the show notes about all of these events and the textbook that you mentioned and all the other things that have come up. Sachi, do you have any final message or call to action for the audience?
I think call to action is eat more seaweed. Be intentional about where you're eating it from. Try and eat it every day and get your friends to eat more of it. Like, I feel like your audience knows this too. I really think that we can build the future of food and future farming and the future of health. You know, truly, this is a win-win-win thing. And I think we have a time-limited window within which to do it, because big industry is going to come in and start to take over the seaweed industry, I believe. I think, you know, you probably, you know, here's what your thoughts are on that. So if we can put protocols around sort of the regenerative aspect of that supply chain into place today and make sure that we avoid the mistakes we made on land before we go in and kind of like monocrop and industrialize the ocean, I do think we have a time limited window within which to do that. So next 3 to 5 years, we need to do it right. So eat more seaweed, eat more sustainable regenerative seaweed is my call to action.
Fantastic. Where can people find you and Rootless and order the Daily Bites?
So we're only shipping within the US for now.
Yeah.
But the next time you're in the US, you'd have to tell me. I'll send you some product.
Will do.
So we are primarily direct-to-consumer. The website's called getrootless.com. We're doing a lot of education on Instagram and LinkedIn and constantly updating our blog. So I'm hoping that we can sort of become like the resource hub for you and for people who are interested, for consumers who are interested in seaweed and health specifically.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for your passion and your knowledge. It's been a blast.
Thank you. These were amazing existential questions. I love them.